Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Investigative historian and journalist Gareth Porter joins us. His articles appear regularly in Interpress Service and other news outlets. He specializes in U.S. national security policy and is author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. We discuss U.S. intelligence strategies in the Middle East that could include an attack on Iran, how special interests in the U.S. and Israel have been working to change public opinion that would facilitate an attack on Iran despite intelligence indicating that this is neither necessary nor wise. Gareth Porter, welcome.
Thanks very much, Dori.
With so many important stories coming out lately about Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Iraq, too, which one should take most of our attention, or how do we classify the importance here? There's just so much to dive through.
Well, you've raised a very important question, and one that has been troubling me as well. What is my priority at this stage of the development of American policy in the Middle East? You know, on one hand, I think the stage of the Afghan war is such that the policy of military intervention there is extremely vulnerable politically. I've used the term that the Iraq 2006 moment for the Afghan war is rapidly approaching, or it's upon us already, and therefore this is a policy crisis that deserves a very close attention and scrutiny. On the other hand, the bigger danger to world peace and to the well-being and security of Americans is the potential for war against Iran, and I would add, the degree to which the proponents of aggression, naked aggression against Iran, have been successful in essentially turning public opinion and political opinion in the United States around from the position of a few years ago when only a minority of people believed that Iran represented a threat to the United States to a clear majority now who say that they believe Iran is a threat to the United States. So in the end, you know, I do come back to Iran being a greater threat, a greater danger, a kind of continuing crisis that we need to spend more time and energy on as journalists and as activists.
And you've been reporting on some very interesting developments having to do with whether or not this source that the CIA supposedly kidnapped was actually kidnapped, or did he come to the CIA? Is he a double agent? Why don't we start there and then, you know, move towards some of the other details here?
Sure. This is a very big story, and it's an important story precisely because it's an indicator of something much bigger. And by that, I mean that what actually happened in the case of Shahram Amiri, the Iranian scientist who disappeared from Saudi Arabia, then reappeared on videos earlier this year, and then suddenly made his denouement from the United States, where he had been either held against his will or was voluntarily remaining during 2009-2010. To appear in the Pakistani embassy and to demand a return trip back to Iran. His case is a signal of the very complex and intense pressures that are being brought to bear, have been brought to bear from outside the United States as well as within the United States to change the 2007 national intelligence estimate saying that Iran did not have a nuclear weapons program active. And so that's really the starting point, it seems to me, for understanding that case, that it is against the background of these intense pressures led, of course, by Israel and the pro-Israeli forces in the United States and abroad to get the CIA and the U.S. intelligence community to do a new intelligence estimate that would, in fact, conclude that Iran is working actively on a nuclear weapon rather than the previous estimate that it was not working on a nuclear weapon. So Shahram Amiri was not a nuclear scientist. This is the first point to bear in mind. Contrary to virtually all of the coverage of this case early on, that is last year and earlier this year, suggesting that he was an important nuclear scientist in the Iranian program, the fact is that he was either a specialist on radiation safety or the health uses of radioisotopes. These are the two different variations on the more general theme that he was completely peripheral to the Iranian nuclear program. This much seems to be very clear. And we now have reason to believe, I think, that he was working for U.S. intelligence at one point. We don't know exactly when, but there have been statements that his information contributed to the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate, which is really quite interesting in itself. And I have concluded, based on my investigation, that both the official line in Iran and the line that Shahram Amiri himself was taking in at least a couple of those videos, and the line taken by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other news media last spring and this summer about Amiri were both lies. He was not kidnapped and taken away by force from Saudi Arabia by the CIA, nor was he contributing information suggesting that Iran has nuclear weapons. I think that he was a walk-in to a U.S. embassy or other office, maybe a consular office in Turkey, and offered his services to the U.S. in trying to track the nuclear program, but apparently admitted from the beginning that he was not really part of the program himself, but that he did know people who were in the program. And I have reason to believe, based on all of my investigation, that he, in fact, was probably a double agent from the beginning. I think that he was a perfect double agent in the sense that he really didn't know anything. There was no danger that he was going to spill the beans to tell secrets about the nuclear program to the United States intelligence. And the CIA was so eager for their, what I call their curveball, not just myself, but one of my former intelligence official sources says that the CIA was so eager to have their curveball on the Iranian nuclear program that they basically bit on this double agent, this dangle, as it's called in the spy trade, and basically bent the rules or suspended their normal procedures to take on Amiri as an intelligence source. The bottom line is that what Amiri was telling the CIA through his handlers is that there is no Iranian nuclear weapons program, and he was consistent on that. And so, in fact, ironically, despite the news media narrative that has told us that Amiri was telling the CIA that Iran was indeed carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program, the exact opposite is the case. And so it appears that he is, in fact, going to be one contributor, not by any means the only one or the most important one, to the next intelligence estimate, what they call a memorandum to holders, because it is a continuation or a revision of the previous national intelligence estimate, that estimate will continue to conclude that Iran does not have an active nuclear weapons program.
Well, Gareth Porter, you mentioned curveball. I want to ask about the role that might have been played by Amiri. In other words, what were they looking for from him? Did it have more to do with helping convince the public to go along with a policy, which we saw, you know, in part with curveball? And I think we're talking about Ahmed Shalabi, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Were we looking for someone who could sell the policy, either in New York at the UN or internationally or to the American people who are funding the bill for all of this? Or was it really to do with this memorandum to holders or with intelligence? Because I have to say, it almost seems like we see either a mistake being made, the CIA outsmarting itself maybe, or we see just a similar sort of problem for the U.S. military and the intelligence community in the Middle East, where they don't know which side any of their sources that they're working with are on a given day.
Right, and the answer is that both of those apply to this case. They did indeed, apparently, hope for the kind of revelations that Curveball, this former Iraqi official who claimed to have personal knowledge of Saddam's mobile bioweapons labs, which of course turned out not to exist, you know, they hoped for somebody like that who could provide, if not personally, then lead them to somebody who could provide that kind of personal testimony about Iranian covert nuclear weapons work. And instead, of course, what they got was somebody who said, gee, I don't really have personal knowledge, but the folks that I talk to who are nuclear scientists say, no, there's nothing like that going on. So obviously a bitter disappointment all around for the CIA, and even more so, and more importantly, a bitter disappointment for those political forces who were putting pressure on the CIA to do exactly this, to come up with a curveball. And then I'm talking here about, you know, not only the Israelis, the European three, the UK, Germany, and France, who have lined up solidly with the Israeli position, saying that, yes, we're sure that Iran is hell-bent to get nuclear weapons, and have bent their own intelligence reporting and analysis to conform to that conclusion, to that sort of preconceived idea about the Iranian program. And I'm talking as well about officials and political figures in the United States who have been pushing for a revision of the National Intelligence Estimate ever since it came out in 2007, as well as the quality news media, the Washington Post and the New York Times, particularly the New York Times, being the worst offenders here, continuing to write stories that month after month, year after year, hammer away at the theme that it's obvious that this 2007 NIE was wrong, that it was politicized, that it must have been that the CIA was trying to use the intelligence estimate to force the Bush administration not to carry out a military option against Iran and so forth. All of these forces, I think, have been working not so much in a conspiratorial manner, not that they're secret meetings, you know, that sort of plot the next steps week by week or month by month, but rather working from the same set of biases about the Iranian program, which spring from the entire history of the Western world, and particularly the American mistakes in its view of Iran and its nuclear program, going back all the way to the beginning of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And there's a whole history there that really needs to be subject to a revision, which is, by the way, something that I'm hoping to do in a book that I'm starting to work on.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. We're joined by Gareth Porter for a discussion on his recent stories in Interpress Service about U.S. intelligence and military policy toward the Mideast. We asked Gareth Porter about the general importance of the Office of Director of National Intelligence, an office held by Dennis Blair until recently. On Thursday, July 29th, shortly after our interview with Gareth Porter, it was announced that retired Air Force Lieutenant General and Defense Department Intelligence Chief James Clapper would be confirmed as Blair's replacement. Clapper famously asserted in 2003 that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein moved his weapons to Syria. Iraq did not have WMD, according to later reports. Here Clapper is questioned by Senator Levin during confirmation hearings.
Now, the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act says that the director of the CIA reports to the DNI. Is that your understanding?
Yes, sir. The governance of foreign relationships, which are the province of the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and they are to be overseen, quote unquote, by the DNI. That is an area of ambiguity, I think.
It's interesting. This was a position that was created, you know, after 9/11, of course, with the idea that we needed somebody to sort of knock heads together in the intelligence community and make sure everyone was sharing intelligence about terrorist threats with everybody else. Somebody who would stand above the CIA and its institutional interests, as well as the FBI and so forth. But in fact, what happens is inevitably, given human nature and bureaucratic interests, there is an inevitable rivalry between the Director of National Intelligence and the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. They are both very powerful figures, and the CIA does not welcome the entrance onto the scene of somebody who is able to direct them to do things or to constrain their power. And you have the case of Dennis Blair, who was fired by President Obama earlier this year, who ran afoul of Panetta, the director of a Central Intelligence Agency, and also, of course, was not popular in the White House, in part because I think he was a truth teller a little bit more than the White House wanted him to be. That's simply the political institutional background of this question of how the MEK has related to the intelligence community in the past and the question of its status as a terrorist organization. First of all, I don't think that is going to change here in the United States, it's still too clear that the MEK has not changed its character, that it's still run by the same people who were carrying out bombings of civilians in Iran, as well as carrying out Saddam's dirty work within Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. I don't see that changing for the time being, at least. And I would also say that the U.S. intelligence community understands that the MEK is really not a reliable source on the Iranian nuclear program. They know very well that the MEK did not discover the Natanz enrichment site in 2002, despite the fact that it announced it at a news conference here in Washington, D.C. In August of 2002, and thus somehow achieved a degree of credibility with the news media, which was entirely undeserved. The intelligence community knows that what really happened was that satellite photography, which was available to both the United States and Israel, showed that Natanz and Arak were two nuclear facilities, although it wasn't exactly clear in the case of Natanz what it was. And that information was passed on to the MEK by the Israelis, who had already established a close relationship, a working relationship with the MEK since at least the late 1990s. And the MEK has been used repeatedly by the Israelis to, as they put it, to launder intelligence that they want to be passed on to the public or to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, so that it's not clear that it comes from the Israelis, because it would be understood that that then is obviously a way of advancing Israeli interests in demonizing Iran and trying to tilt the policy of the United States and other countries toward Iran, and that somehow it would appear to be independent of the Israelis. But it's well known in international intelligence circles that the MEK represents the Israelis, that any information the MEK comes out with is very likely to be coming from the Israelis and to represent the Israeli point of view.
Gareth Porter also criticized an April story about Shahram Amiri by Joby Warrick and Greg Miller, writing for The Washington Post. They claimed Amiri provided sensitive information about a long-hidden Iranian nuclear enrichment plant. Their source was actually the political arm of the MEK, Mujahideen-e-Khalq. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq has been classified by the U.S. State Department as a terrorist organization. MEK has a stated aim of toppling the Iranian government. Interestingly, the U.S. reconsidered their classification as a terrorist organization recently.
This is a very important question. Exactly what was going on here when the Washington Post published that story? Where were they getting their information? It's a bit murky, to say the least. But clearly, they were talking to officials in the U.S. government. Presumably, they had some CIA source, maybe it was Panetta, who knows, who was willing to feed them really misinformation. It appears at this point that Panetta has decided to come down strongly politically on the side of basically continuing the narrative that Iran is hell-bent to get nuclear weapons. He's been making statements now that indicate that. That reflects obviously a political position, a political interest, rather than being a reflection of what intelligence analysis is showing, at least as I understand it. But the point is that the Post and the New York Times are talking to the people who are feeding them essentially a political line. They're not talking to analysts. They're not talking to people who are in a position to reflect the raw data or the analysis of that data. They do not know what is being fed into. It's very clear that David Sanger of the New York Times and the intelligence reporters for the Post do not have access to the people who are working on the memorandum to holders, the follow-on to the National Intelligence Estimate on Iran. Inevitably, they are being fed a political line which reflects the sort of political balance, if you will, in the United States on this question. The Obama administration tilting in the direction that they see the wind blowing on the question of Iran, that it's important for them to be seen as taking a hard line at this point. I think that's one of the factors that explains why the Washington Post comes out with that kind of a story. But the other factor, which is equally important, is the history of the wrong-headed assumptions about Iran that go back, as I said earlier, to the early 1980s. I mean, it's astonishing if you go back and look at the historical record of what U.S. officials including U.S. intelligence officials, and I include here particularly Bob Gates when he was deputy director of CIA and then director of CIA, what he was saying about the Iranian nuclear program. I mean, they were talking about being sure that Iran was going for intending to get nuclear weapons at a stage when there was absolutely no reason whatsoever to suspect any such thing. There was not the slightest hint of any such intent on the part of Iran. And yet, even at that early stage, in 1983-84, when Iran was simply saying, we want to continue the nuclear power plant that the United States had helped the Shah to establish during his regime, they were immediately demonized for that. This is a process which went on year after year. You have the drip-drip of stories, layer upon layer, which creates an almost impossible bias to overcome without some sort of a political force behind you that would have the ability to begin to counterbalance that narrative that has become so prevalent and so powerful in the United States and everywhere else in the world as well.
The special interests you're talking about, including AIPAC, tend to focus on security interests, you know, the quote-unquote threat posed by Iran for Israel. But the latest round of sanctions, hard won by the Obama administration, really impact the people of Iran. They target the oil industry, but that, of course, has, you know, major consequences economically. And then we have sort of the global economic interests here at stake. What about that as a major factor in the formation of military policy?
This is a very big question, which I'm not sure we're even going to be able to begin to touch the surface of, but let me give it a try. I have a view on the sources of what is wrong with American policy, the sources of American empire that I'm sure differ from those of yourself and many of your listeners. But I believe that it is vital that we identify the precise nature of the power interests that are involved in these policies, and specifically in the case of Iran, what is at stake here for whom. And I would direct people's attention to the twin origins of the policy toward Iran since 1979. That is to say, the interests of Israel in demonizing Iran, you know, I don't think I need to go into great detail about what that means, on one hand, and the interests of the U.S. national security bureaucracy, and particularly of the U.S. military, in having Iran as a regional enemy in the Middle East to replace the Soviet Union once it was gone from the scene. There was an obvious crisis in the national security bureaucracy, and particularly the military services, after 1991. Because of the imminent demise of the Soviet Union, or the actual demise of the Soviet Union, and they were in a panic. And it's no accident that it was in the early to mid-1990s that you had the emergence of the idea of rogue regimes, with Iran being atop the pecking order in this regard, one of the favorites of the military in terms of identifying the enemy against which they had to be prepared to fight wars. And then you had the development of new military doctrines, which involved the U.S. military being used for regime change, which then came to fruition with the Bush administration. So you have this twin set of interests, which are clearly the two most powerful political forces in this country in terms of foreign policy and national security policy, combining to drive U.S. policy in the direction of demonizing Iran from the beginning in the early 1980s. So I don't think it's necessary, and indeed I think it's somewhat diversionary, to look for an economistic explanation for the policy toward Iran. By that I mean to look for economic interests, corporate interests in the form of oil companies or corporations which are not directly related to the national security state, you know, providing services and weaponry to the military services themselves and to the Pentagon, to understand the dynamics of U.S. policy toward Iran. So that's my take in brief on what really underlies the history of this misbegotten policy.
And you're looking at this as a journalist, as a historian who
That's right. And I have to say that my understanding of the dynamics of policymaking toward Iran, and indeed toward Iraq as well, and Afghanistan have been informed by the book that I did on the path to war in Vietnam, which directed me as I began to read the documents, both those already published and those in the archives, in the JFK and LBJ archives, to understand that what I was seeing was a national security bureaucracy that had achieved such power to drive the national security agenda, to shape policy options, and to put pressure on the White House, even if the president was reluctant to go to war, that we had essentially a power that was out of control in this country. We had created a Frankenstein early in the Cold War, which continued to accumulate political power that was out of control and was really able to drive the agenda and to make it very, very difficult for a president to say no to war in Vietnam. And so, I mean, I think that that undoubtedly gave me the framework within which I began to see policies such as the one we're talking about here in Iran.
Gareth Porter, you said you were going to be now working on a book about all of this. What can we expect to see, though, in Interpress Service?
You mean the next phase of stories?
The next saga here. I think we can see where the story is heading, and it's remarkable that it can actually even be tracked the way you're tracking it.
Well, I don't honestly know exactly where the story is going, but I can tell you that I am working on the question of how the pro-Israeli lobby in this country, working closely, of course, with the Israeli government, is trying to maneuver the United States into a position to not just support an Israeli attack on Iran, because that would not be sufficient. What the Israelis and the pro-Israeli lobby in this country are really after is a U.S. policy of being prepared to wage full-scale war against Iran.
We'll hear more of this interview with Gareth Porter next time on the driving force behind U.S. and Israeli policy toward Iran and other parts of the Middle East. Are they institutionalizing long war policies rather than examine long-standing policy errors? What are the real costs to global security?
Mossad had an active program in 2003-2004, when these documents were written, to influence the world's news media, as well as governments, on the question of Iran's nuclear program.
Investigative journalist and historian Gareth Porter is a correspondent for Interpress Service News Agency, ipsnews.net. He is author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed, whose music was featured in the film The Oil Factor. Underwriting for this program was brought to you by JeremyRHammond.com, political analysis from outside the standard framework. Jeremy R. Hammond is the founder and editor of ForeignPolicyJournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for his work covering Israel's assault on Gaza and the U.S. role. He has been a guest on Talk Nation Radio to discuss the 2009 presidential election in Iran and its aftermath. Recent stories at JeremyRHammond.com include an analysis of the legality of Israel's naval blockade of Gaza and the attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that left 9 Turkish peace activists dead.